Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Questions about what triggered a car and knife attack on the Ohio State University campus on Monday persist today after ISIS media took credit for inspiring the 18-year-old Somali-born attacker. Coming up, we'll hear from a leader in the Columbus Somali community and also an expert on ISIS. Joining us now by phone is OSU President Dr. Michael Drake. Thanks for your time and welcome back.
Nice to be here, Jen. Excuse me.
That's okay. What are the lessons learned from how the university responded on Monday while the incident unfolded?
Well, I think, you know, we rehearse for circumstances like these that we always hope and pray won't happen, but we see just from reading the newspapers happen in our cities or our communities from time to time, and so we do lots of preparation, tabletops, et cetera, on what to do if we happen to have someone on campus who seems intent on doing harm to others. And actually, the things worked about as they should have. You know, I reviewed this, and from the time that there was the first report of a vehicle on the sidewalk hitting people to the time that the suspect had been neutralized was less than a minute. And from the time that that happened to the time that our campus-wide alert system had been activated was less than a minute. And so from the very beginning, from the first person seeing something wrong to the time that the campus alert went out was about a minute and 45 seconds. And that's a dramatic improvement over what it would have been even a year or two ago. And so those kinds of things worked well. You know, we always wish something like this wouldn't happen, and we always are thinking about what we could do to keep ourselves even safer in the future.
How much of that has to do with how students like the attacker connect to the campus? What about that?
Well, students like the attacker. And this is a very unusual. This is a one-off person, and so. Yeah, so I guess I'm not sure what you mean exactly. I mean, people aren't like this, you know. This is an extraordinarily unusual event, and so I can't say much about. I don't know that I'd say that anyone's like that person. But what were you? Maybe you can rephrase what you meant.
Well, I guess he had been quoted in the Lantern newspaper, the student newspaper, as feeling like he didn't really know where he could go on campus to feel comfortable praying and that kind of a thing. And I'm wondering about that cultural outreach on the OSU campus. Yeah,
fine. So that's I understand. But yeah, so, you know, we are a big campus, and particularly when students arrive for the first time, they have to kind of find themselves. And many, it's the first time they've lived away from home, et cetera. And some of them, day one, you know, in the first hour, they bond with people, they take advantage of our programs, they're excited, and everything is great. Some other fraction of our student body take a longer time to feel really comfortable, and we know particularly this can take a little longer for transfer students or for students who don't live on campus, and so we have myriad programs to make those things available. We do countless outreach. I speak to the students multiple times and say things that tell them things that are available. And Student Life has programs really every day during the first days on campus. And then we have 1,000 clubs, and then we have support services that are available within seconds by the telephone. And we have RAs and TAs and lots of people there for everyone. But there are a range of some people are able to bond really quickly that way. Some people take longer, and so that there's just the range.
Did the response to the Wexner Center incident, or the Wexner Center for the Arts shooter last year, influence the response to the Monday attack?
It did in a couple of ways. Let me back up and answer something else about your other question.
Sure.
That is about students who are from different religions or faiths finding a faith community that supports them. We work really hard to make that possible and true, and we hear overwhelmingly that it's true. So his comments within the first couple of days of school, this was in August, my second or third day of school, that he hadn't found a place to settle in, that would be something that we don't hear much. And if we hear such a thing, we work to make it true. And I meet with other students who are Muslim, and again, students from a variety of faiths, and overwhelmingly, they're able to find a community of support. And so I would say that his comments were unusual, not things that we hear often.
Mm-hmm.
I noted that they were made on the second or third day of school, and we would expect that within days that something like that, that person could meet friends or find people to help support him. And so that would be what would happen normally. But again, this was a not normal circumstance.
Right.
Let me then not dodge your question.
Sure,
remember your question. And I'll say that I thought last year that although again, that situation was over very quickly, that it took longer to have the Buckeye Alert System activated than I felt was appropriate. And so we looked directly at that system, and we revamped it and put a series of protocols in place to make it that the system would work more quickly. And this year it worked much more quickly, and we were pleased about that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with OSU President Dr. Michael Drake right now. We're talking in the wake of a vigil last night honoring the victims in the attack on Monday on the OSU campus. There's a bill pending at the Ohio State House, Dr. Drake, that would allow students to carry concealed guns on campus. What are your thoughts as the leader of a major Big Ten university in the United States about that?
None of my colleagues think that that's a good idea, of course. And, you know, we had a circumstance here where there was someone who was a threat to the community, and he was neutralized by a professional within 1 minute. And that would be how we would think that things could go. I know this is a controversial bill, but I would just say that, you know, we are comfortable with professionals dealing with situations like this. And we had, again, on our campus just a few days ago, a circumstance where the threat was neutralized within 1 minute and injuries were kept to a minimum. And we think that's how things are designed to work.
Going back to the issue of comfort level for students of the Muslim faith, some students are fearful of retaliation because of their ethnicity and or religion. And you've already issued some messages in recent weeks, since the election, as a matter of fact, regarding this. What do you say to them? What do you say to their parents? Are they safe? And how can they make themselves safer if they don't feel that way?
Well, I certainly have heard from many students that this is the case. And you know, I think always extraordinarily unfortunate when an individual behaves in a reprehensible fashion, and then entire groups of people who are often routinely horrified by the actions of that individual are then somehow made to feel responsible for that. So I think that's always something we all have to be very careful to avoid, and we need to know that people who are innocent and law-abiding and great supporters of our country need to be treated as such. And we do all we can to be a welcoming and embracing community broadly, and that's the message that we teach, and it's how we try to live. And we care very much about our students, whoever they are. You know, I was thinking about this yesterday, that we feel almost an individual relationship with each of our students and want to do everything we can to help them feel safe and to thrive. And, you know, we want to continue to share that message, and we try to share it with the students directly and try to reassure their parents. And we know that it's a complicated and difficult world.
Have you heard from leaders of other universities in the aftermath of this incident?
You know, I've heard from people from all over the country. Dozens, 100 maybe, just all of us feel so similar and so connected, and it's been very gratifying to hear those levels of support, and I do appreciate it.
Have you met the victims yet, all of them?
I met everyone who was in our hospital and in Riverside Hospital. A couple who were in another one of the hospitals, I think, were treated and released before we had a chance to get there, but I was able to visit the people who are here at our Wexner Medical Center and then also the people who were at Riverside Hospital. And I was happy to see that, you know, they had significant injuries in some cases and moderate injuries in others, enough to be treated and hospitalized. But I think all but one or two are now released, and I'm just so thankful that the injuries weren't more severe. And you know, we think about them every day, all day, and are wishing them all speedy and complete recovery.
Have you met with the officer who shot the attacker?
I did, and thanked him again for his courage and his professionalism. And, you know, these are chaotic, evolving situations where there's you don't know what's happening, you know, and it's all happening relatively, or not relatively, just in incredibly quickly. And he was able to arrive on the scene, respond appropriately, and neutralize the threat. And so we thanked him for that. He, I would note, was very quick to thank those who had trained him and prepared him. And I think he was quoted as saying, you know, he just did what any one of his colleagues would have done in a similar circumstance, and that he's here to protect us and make us safe, and we appreciate that.
It's always a traumatic event when something like that happens. Did he seem okay? Is he struggling at all?
Well, you know, we're all human,
yeah.
And these are awful. It's an awful circumstance, period. And so he'd been through a horrible, awful circumstance where he, you know, had to use force to stop a threat. And I know that it will take. I mean, that's something he'll have to incorporate into his own psyche moving forward. But again, he's a professional that was trained and used his training appropriately to neutralize a situation that could have been much worse. And I think he was pleased that he was able to do that and relieved that it was all done. But I'm sure this will be something that he'll need support with for some time, and we provide that support. You know, we look forward to him continuing to serve us.
What's your understanding about progress in the investigation by law enforcement into this case?
You know, I don't know anything specific about that. I mean, I know that when these things happen, we do investigations, of course, and I know that those investigations take some time, and this is now 48 hours, and there are many more questions to be answered, and so, you know, I know that we have all appropriate resources directed toward getting those answers, and I'll look forward to learning them as they become available.
Dr. Michael Drake, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Ann. Look forward to talking to you again soon. Take care.
That's OSU President Dr. Michael Drake. Coming up, we're going to hear from national security reporter for The Washington Post, who has written extensively about ISIS, the terrorist organization claiming responsibility for inspiring the attack on campus on Monday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Why the 18-year-old Somali-born Ohio State University student launched a car and knife attack on the OSU campus on Monday remains unclear. And even after the ISIS news agency claimed responsibility for inspiring the attack by Abdul Razak Ali Artan, questions remain about his motivations. Washington Post national security reporter Joby Warwick is the author of an authoritative book about ISIS entitled Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. He joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Hi there, Ann. Good to be with you.
Reports about ISIS claiming responsibility in the Monday attack refer to the media arm of the Islamic State. How significant is this branch of the terrorist organization?
Well, they've got a pretty sophisticated media arm, and it's really been something to behold over the last couple of years. They are very nimble. They're very quick to take advantage of opportunities, and this is one for them. There's no evidence so far that the Ohio State student had anything specifically to do with ISIS, but ISIS is calling him his soldier. They're getting propaganda credit for it, and they jumped on this fairly quickly. Within a few hours, they're saying that this is one of their guys, even though it may not be literally true.
ISIS said that Artan carried out the Monday attack in response to calls to target citizens of international coalition countries. What are the other examples of ISIS taking this kind of credit in attacks like this?
Well, this is something they do all the time, and if you look at their media closely, which I unfortunately have to do, It's filled with suggestions, some very specific. They, because they had the infamous attack in Nice, France last summer, in which they, some guy in a truck, killed, some dozens of people just by driving down a crowded promenade. And so their people were suggesting on social media, do the same in America at the Macy's Day Parade. And a lot of us are kind of holding our breath, on Thanksgiving, just waiting to see if somebody might try something. And, it's that kind of thing. It's suggestions about just, stabbings, and they'll put on graphic demonstrations, or they'll put out magazine articles about how to do these things. And so their social messages are filled with suggestions aimed exactly at young men like Artan, who might be, unhappy for whatever reason, and we may never know what his reasons are, but kind of egging them on and suggesting that if they want to be a good Muslim, they need to do something like this.
There was the knifing at the shopping mall in St. Cloud, Minnesota. What is it about these car attacks and knife attacks that is, I guess, the new preferred attack mode for for ISIS?
It's striking. It's kind of, we don't want to, breathe a sigh of relief here that sort of the weapons or the attacks haven't been more sophisticated. They actually have been fairly crude, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And this young man apparently just bought his knife that day or very recently. And so, that's part of the appeal we're seeing with ISIS now, because they're getting a bit impatient, it seems. They don't really have time or the means to plan some 9/11 style attack. It doesn't seem to be within their grasp. And so they're telling people just to do the simplest thing, even pick up a rock, do anything and kill anyone. And right now, I think that message is an urgent one for ISIS, because they are under a lot of pressure. They're losing territory. They're getting pushed back by the day in Mosul and other places in their caliphate. And so they're looking for supporters around the world to do something, even if it's something as crude as taking a knife and slashing people.
How in particular do they appeal to people like Artan, 18 years old? What in particular are they doing or saying to them that suggests to you that, they're good at getting that demographic?
Yeah, it's very complicated, because if you look at Artan's writings on Facebook, he seems to sort of admire Al Qaeda, more specifically than ISIS. He talks about this Al Qaeda, American Al Qaeda official who was killed a couple years ago named Al-Waqi, and mm-hmm. talks about his writings and his call for jihad. And as we know, Al Qaeda and ISIS really don't like each other very much. They're very much in opposite ends of the sort of the jihadi spectrum in many ways. But you see him talking about that, but you also see him expressing sympathy for sort of the suffering of Muslims in Syria in particular, and he talks about that as well. And in the beginning, a lot of ISIS's success in motivating young people to do things on their behalf was making this broad appeal to support, to defend Muslims, to defend the faith, and sort of suggesting that Muslims are being persecuted in places in the world and you need to do something about it. And I think that's part of the appeal to people like this young man, kind of showering him with images of Muslim suffering, of repression, and that kind of gets to the core of his ideology and his personal beliefs and makes him feel that I need to do something, even if it's on a very small scale, even if it means sacrificing my own life.
The New Yorker published a story this week that referred to the Islamic State's quote-unquote slick online magazine, I think it's Rumia, and its special issue on knife attacks last month. The New Yorker said that the incident on Monday could have come straight out of the ISIS manual. When, again, there's not any direct connection between the attacker on the OSU campus and this, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think there's no question that if you look at what this young man did, it does seem to have been inspired by these very specific suggestions and directions about how to carry out attacks. When we first heard about an incident on the campus, of course, we first heard there was a shooting, and what was it? It could have been any of a number of things, any number of causes. And then when we heard that someone had deliberately, apparently, hit people with a car and then was slashing, someone with a knife, I mean, immediately we started thinking back in my shop about, well, this is exactly what ISIS has been asking people to do to the detail. So it did sound very much like ISIS had been successful, at least in giving this guy some notions. And so that, from that sense, this was definitely right out of their playbook. I guess one other point to think about, I mean, he keeps talking in this young man in his Facebook posts and elsewhere about the sense that he, feels afraid to pray, feels that he doesn't, he's sort of scared to be a Muslim. And, that's something that ISIS also wants to exploit. And there are slick magazines. They talk about this gray zone among Muslims in Europe particularly, but also in North America, Muslims that don't really feel that they're part of the culture here. They feel a bit alienated. Maybe they're not successful as people. And so ISIS wants to drive a backlash. They want to see the West repress and crack down and mistreat Muslims, because that drives a young man like Artan over the edge. And that's been a fear, as we've seen sort of the political rhetoric over the last few months, that Muslims who may have been somewhat unhappy in their situation, if they feel that they are under attack by the sort of the dominant culture, they feel like they're being repressed, that they'd be maybe even more likely to do something like this young man did. Not that it's ever justified, but that may be the thinking, and that's something that ISIS wants to provoke.
Columbus is considered a welcoming community to Muslim refugees. It makes you wonder, what about in places where it's not so welcoming?
Yeah, I mean, it illustrates the complexity of the whole refugee problem, because this man was a legal citizen, mm-hmm. but he was the child of a woman who came here as a refugee. But, you know, there have been every possible, you know, scenario that you can imagine. You know, the guy that shot up the Pulse nightclub was an American citizen who was born here to, you know, an Afghan family that came here years earlier and were not refugees per se. You know, they're second generation. They're all kinds of people that end up doing things like this. And the I guess the point is that just by saying, well, no more refugees, no matter how carefully vetted, that doesn't necessarily end the problem, and yet it does sort of make the point that we do have to be very vigilant when we're screening people who come to this country. So you can see both sides there.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Right now, I'm talking with national security reporter for the Washington Post, Joby Warrick. He is also the author of the 2015 book, Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I'm turning now to Norma in Hilliard. You're on the air, Norma. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As we've been looking at for any connection between ISIS, I'm wondering if authorities are looking at any impact. I'm a member of the Muslim community here in Central Ohio, and the Trump effect on our community with Steve Bannon, white supremacists. This was a recent immigrant to the state who doesn't know how much OSU is a very friendly place for Muslim students, including my kids who went there. I know now, like particularly since the election, how many their people are telling you, you have to keep your papers with you or police will arrest you on suspicion, and then they'll hold you and see whether you're in the country legally.
Okay.
Threatened threats of deportation. Okay. School kids are threatening other kids with
right.
deportation.
Well,
Muslim
we've heard,
women are being
right.
attacked.
Right.
So,
well, Norma, we've heard a lot about that, but you're asking about what the impact of the Trump victory may have or not on all of this. Joby Warrick, and thank you, Norma, for that call. We appreciate it. Joby Warrick, what do you think?
Well, here's the thing. You know, there is a Muslim community in this country of about 3 million people. And what a lot of folks don't understand about the Muslim community here is it actually is a very educated and relatively well-off community, as opposed to the Muslim communities you see around Paris or in Belgium. These aren't people who came over as looking for day labor jobs. They came over to go to school. They're doctors and lawyers, and their per capita income is as a group is among the highest. So these are people who have a very much a vested interest in living a normal life in this country. And so they do get very upset when they see these kinds of attacks. They do tend to cooperate fairly closely with law enforcement, and they are very much afraid of the Trump effect, just, you know, not to be political about it, but mm-hmm. when they see appointments to the president-elect's cabinet, you know, a national security advisor who has made, you know, statements very publicly, you know, suggesting that Islam has a cancer in the center of it. I mean, that's people can argue about the revolution within Islam and how there's a bit of a war between, you know, over Islamic identity, but to say something sort of that such a blanket statement and essentially disparage an entire religion, these Muslim Americans take that very personally, and they're worried about the effect on their community. They're worried about young people, young men and women who grew up in this country who are now feeling that they're going to be targeted by this new government. And so that's I think it kind of behooves the president-elect and his administration to really reach out and to reassure these people, just as President Bush did, George W. Bush did, after the 9/11 attacks. went to Congress, made a speech, made very clear that this was not a war against Muslims. You can look at his speech and see how careful he was to say that we're not fighting Islam. He went to a mosque that very next week to show us solidarity with Muslim Americans who were under attack as well and who lost people in 9/11. So those kinds of messages are important for a leader to project right now because of the anxiety that people have.
Norma, thanks again for that call. We appreciate it. Prakash in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Prakash.
Hi. This is Prakash. So what I think is inaccurate is your gentleman saying that, Muslim feelings will be ruffled and hence there will be more violence. I mean, we have seen, the U.S. is the most liberal and kind place to, form your life, start your life all over again in. And yet we have reprisals. I do not think that it's a myth to say that, hey, just because you say something against Islam, there are going to be even more reprisals. And that is a kind of fear-mongering on the other side. So I think this gentleman is painting an inaccurate picture, and we got to straighten that up. I mean, that's my comment.
Okay.
Thanks.
Joby Warwick?
I think we're probably looking at this fairly, very much the same way, just because I don't think that there is, as I said, there is the majority of Muslim people in this country, and of course we talk to them all the time, very much like being here, that they're not offended by every comment that people make because they understand it's a democracy and people are free to speak their minds. And so that, just because someone has said something negative politically doesn't mean that there's going to be some uprising. Mm-hmm. But they do worry about the people on the margins, people who, for whatever reason, are unhappy and could be pushed over the edge. And so it's not just rhetoric, but if there are policies that make Muslims feel singled out as unwanted, then if you have a kid who has conflicted feelings anyway, it's the kind of phenomenon that could make him, drive him to an extreme. And so that's something that Muslim Americans, some of the Muslim American groups that we talk to, are concerned about.
Thank you, Prakash, for that call. ISIS, well, what might be the significance of the timing of the attack? You mentioned that everyone was sort of on tenterhooks during the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade, but this was the first day back at school after Thanksgiving break. Is that a thing for, from the playbook of ISIS?
I don't think it was that well planned in this particular case.
Okay.
And I guess we may never know exactly what set this kid off. It looks like he got really angry about something in the last, few days.
Mm-hmm.
And whether the election had something to do with it or just something he saw online that upset him, we just really don't know. What we do know about timing is that ISIS is slowly but surely losing its Iraqi capital right now, Mosul. It's a horrible, bloody fight, but they're losing, and they're going to lose their capital. They're probably going to lose their capital in Syria, too. And as this happens, we see evidence that they're desperate to do something, and there's real concern in Europe right now about sleeper cells, about returnees from ISIS, people who went to fight and they came back home, and that ISIS is going to look for a way to do something even as the caliphate falls. And so in that sense, I think we're at a point in time right now where there is a lot of danger, where ISIS is going to try to do something, and law enforcement's trying to be very vigilant to watch for anything. Allowing that, attacks like this, you can't necessarily prevent or foresee, because this is a young man who had no record, as far as we know, with anyone.
Right.
Had never really done anything untoward. He had a good record as far as we could tell. So there's no warning sign whatsoever. Except a guy went, got a knife, and drove off in his car after dropping his kids off, his siblings off at school. So that's about the hardest thing in the world to try to get ahead of.
Abdul Razak Ali Artan, he is the attacker. He allegedly closed his Facebook rant. I couldn't verify this because I can't see it anymore, but by saying that every single Muslim who disapproves of my actions is a sleeper cell waiting for a signal. And I'm wondering, does that make any sense to you? Is there any significance there for you, Joby Warwick?
I really can't make a lot of sense out of that because it seems like he's contradicting himself. I think maybe it was his hope that people will be shaken by his act into doing something similar, but he's not very clear in his writing. And again, that could just be part of the issue here. Here's someone with some very confused thoughts. I mean, he clearly was very happy, you know, when you saw him getting his associate's degree and his all these wonderful videos
right.
of him just beaming and being so happy with his achievement. And then yet, you know, a few months later, being in this seemingly very desperate place. So there's obviously some things going on in this young man's mind. I think that's important to state just because there are people in a country with 300 million citizens that there are people who just cross over a line for any number of reasons. And if this had been just some kid upset over the football game and who went out and just had too much to drink and slashed people with a knife, we probably wouldn't be talking about this. But it would involve someone who seemed to have been inspired by ISIS, and so it's a national story. And that's just saying that you can't stop every confused, possibly mentally disturbed person from doing something bad.
Joby Warrick, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Great being with you, Ann. Good luck.
That's national security reporter for The Washington Post, Joby Warrick. He's also author of the 2015 book, Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. We will continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Questions about what triggered a car and knife attack on the Ohio State University campus on Monday persist today after ISIS media took credit for inspiring the 18-year-old Somali-born attacker. Local Muslim groups were quick to condemn the attack in a press conference on Monday evening. Joining us now to discuss the response from the Muslim and Somali communities, staff attorney for the Ohio chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Roman Iqbal. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Horsad Noah. He's director of the Abu Bakr As-Siddiq Islamic Center, one of the largest Islamic centers in Columbus. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
When news of the attack first reached you, what was your reaction? What did you think?
Well, I was shocked because as someone who mentors the youth, as one of their teachers, most of my students, family members, go to that university. So, of course, I was shocked. I was shocked and shaken as every other citizen in this country.
Is it sort of that feeling of, oh, no, not again? I guess I heard one, I think it was a Muslim student from OSU saying, or a Somali-born or a refugee from Somalia say, all I did was think, please not let it be a Muslim, please not let it be a Muslim.
I'm sure that will be the feeling of every Muslim, especially today, at the time when the level of Islamophobia is at the peak. In fact, Islamophobia today is much higher than the aftermath of September 11th. So definitely that was our feeling, oh God, I hope he's not a Muslim. And then when we realized that he was a Somali ethnically, then of course we were all shocked.
It's at a peak. It's an all-time high, even higher than the post 9/11. That is the Islamophobia in the United States. And yet we had a caller earlier say the United States is a friendly place. It's still probably the most friendly country in the world.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things which is not really talked about is that since the election, the number of Muslims, mosques, just people, neighbors who have, you know, received outreach, flowers, candies, you know, well wishes, cards from the neighbors who are not Muslims, from church groups. So there has been a lot of outreach to Muslims since the election, especially because in this climate of hate crimes that have been committed against Muslims. There has also been a lot of outreach from just absolutely wonderful people to show their support for Muslims.
Which is different. Yes, go ahead, Noah.
Yeah, definitely. I second that. You cannot imagine, and in fact, I was, you know, as a director and a community leader, I was so humbled by the level of love and support. People were bringing cookies and postcards. We are with you. No one can harm you. So I definitely second Iqbal's state.
Is that a big contrast compared to, say, post 9/11?
Yes, really. Of course, now I'm a director, but then I was, you know, very young.
Uh-huh.
But definitely the love is always much higher than the Islamophobia or the harassments we see here and there.
Well, and I guess it should, you know, it should be pointed out that since last December, and especially since the election, even in Columbus, we have seen over a dozen just incidents which have been reported to us of Muslims being verbally assaulted. And sometimes physically assaulted.
When Abdul Artan was profiled in the Lantern earlier this semester, OSU student newspaper, he expressed a fear of praying on campus. And I was surprised when I heard about that because it's not the way OSU operates, all things being equal. He was new to campus. And I'm wondering about that fear of praying in public. What about that? And how do you instruct people in how to go about that? Horsehead Noah?
Well, I went to school here. I never had a problem praying in public. My wife prays in public. My sisters, all of my students, they pray in public. So we never had any problem when it comes to praying in a public.
Do you talk about that, though, at the mosque, about behaviors and what works and what doesn't?
Yes, definitely. All of our sermons are about engaging with our community. As someone who mentors the youth, most of our lectures are about, having a good character, being a peace-loving, law-abiding, productive citizen in this country. And most of our lectures are online, it can be seen.
I was eating at a Somali restaurant, sometime in the past year, and it was right at lunchtime. And so people started to pray, and the proprietor came up to us and said, I don't want to interrupt you, but I just want to let you know that people are praying now and just so you know what's going on and blah, blah, blah. And I went, okay, yeah, all right. You know, I knew what was going on, but what about that kind of behavior, explaining, educating, sharing? Roman?
Right. I mean, look, I read the article as well where the attacker talked about some issues he had. I mean, those issues have nothing to do with what he did. I mean, this was an absolutely savage, heinous attack on his fellow students, which is in no way justifiable to if any issue that he may have had regarding to praying. I don't think there's no connection there. I mean, we obviously are waiting for the FBI to come out and let us know about what were his motivations. But I cannot imagine that that issue with prayer motivated him. And my understanding is, and I was on campus until 2003, that there is space to pray on campus,
mm-hmm.
especially at the New Union. So that should not have been a problem.
And you don't want to connect it with...
Well, of course not. There.
The violence.
Oh, absolutely. There is no connection. And I cannot imagine that could have motivated him. That would just make no sense.
Right.
Have you learned more over the years? I mean, is this something you're studying, what that bridge is from... a religion that is by any stretch of the imagination, you know, by any means, by any in any way considered extremely peaceful and peace loving, to what the breach is or where the bridge is from that to this kind of violence? How what's going on in their minds, or is it just a mental illness?
Look, in Islam, we believe one of the names of God is As-Salam, the source of peace. And the first thing Prophet Muhammad said in his first public speech was, if Shusalam spread the peace, and we are a community that are commanded in their tradition to greet the people by saying, may the peace of God be upon you. But here is the problem. If you are a violent person, you will always be a violent person. It has nothing to do with a religion. It has something to do with the character of the person.
Okay. Nabil in Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. Are there any events that are coming up? Are there any community centers where if people want to learn and meet Muslims, are there any resources available to them?
Right.
Roman Iqbal?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a, I know that Masjid Omar is having on Olentangy is having an open house. I believe they're going to have it today. I know that Masjid Noor, that is the Noor Islamic Cultural Center, is always open for anybody to show up and meet. It would be helpful to call in before people who are not Muslim show up so they can have somebody to greet them and show them around. But almost all mosques in Columbus, in fact, I would say all mosques in Columbus are absolutely open to everybody. If any person wants to go meet Muslims, observe Muslims pray, simply call in before so that you can have somebody to greet you and they will take you around. They will show you Muslims praying. They will have you meet Muslims. It's all mosques in Columbus are open to everybody. And we encourage and welcome people to reach out to mosques.
Do you have people reaching out more, Horsa Noah, at times like this?
Yes. In fact, our mosque is well known by doing events like Meet a Muslim, where we personally invite and engage with people from the church, synagogues and temples to come to the mosque and get to know about Muslims and engage with the Muslims, because studies say that most of our society haven't had a real conversation with a Muslim except what they see on the media. So we do these programs to break and overcome that psychological barrier.
Nabil, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Just a question for the people on the your guests.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if the major Muslim organizations in this country send out people, American Muslims, back to countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran and basically proselytize their co-religionists on tolerance and equal treatment for women and gays and other religions that might exist in their countries. I know that, you know, we have these press conferences after every one of these urging restraint and that Islam is a religion of peace. But it seems to me that the people that really need to hear the message are their co-religionists back in the centers of Islam, specifically Saudi Arabia and Iran. And is there any effort on that part, like a Islamic Peace Corps that would go back and speak to their co-religionists about the American?
Okay. All right, Mike, thank you for that. Roman Iqbal?
You know, there are a lot of conferences being held all around the Muslim world, which are attended by leaders from the American Muslim leadership, American Muslim organizations, who do go out there and address these issues. And you know, there are 56 Muslim countries, Muslim majority countries, 1.6 billion Muslims.
A lot
of
people.
It's not easy to you know, for American Muslim organizations, which are relatively very small in numbers, to go out and do, you know, work on a worldwide level. It's almost impossible. But I do know that there are conferences held all the time. There are events held all the time in the Muslim world, in Muslim majority countries, in the Gulf countries, in the Middle East, about these issues. And that work is being done, and there is active participation from the American Muslim groups in those conferences and events.
It seems to me, though, you know, Horsa Noah, that the Muslim community is getting better at responding immediately when these attacks occur.
Yes. Before that, I just would like to add a few things. We are American Muslims. This is our country. Mm-hmm. Our children are Americans. We have our own concerns and challenges here. But also, we have to remember that most of the great Muslim scholars, for example, someone I would consider my own teacher, the likes of Sheikh Hamza Yusuf and Imam Zaid Shaker, who are globally well-known, they travel around the world spreading the true image of Islam. So we're doing that job, but the media somehow doesn't highlight the good job of our scholars. To come back to your question, yes, Muslims have come left and right, and they have condemned this with the strongest terms. Places like Minneapolis, we had an event which is called Let's Have Tea Together, where people of different faiths came together, and the Muslim community was leading that. So I agree with you. Yeah, Muslims are doing far more better than before.
Yeah. Are there any programs or anything focused on reaching out to youth like the attacker? I mean, he sort of fits this demographic profile. 18, it's always a rough age in anybody's life. But he kind of fits that profile of what ISIS is shooting for. And we have not established, and no one has established, that ISIS is directly involved at all. In fact, I think the Homeland Security is saying now that it was not at all involved, although he might have been inspired. That's hard to draw that conclusion. But are you talking to those, that age group, those boys, the guys coming up into that age group?
I live walking distance from our mosque, which is a large Islamic center. I spend most of my time at the center, and all I do is just educate our youth, teach them, do different programs. For example, we have a program called Mercy on the Wheels, where we clothe the homeless, feed the hungry. We have a program where we engage with the non-Muslims, teach them about the true image of Islam, a lot of interfaith conferences. Having said that, we live at a time when our youth can be radicalized in their bedroom. So regardless of our effort, we will always have a challenge. And this is a global phenomenon. Coming back to the point of ISIS, ISIS are not fools. They will always claim whatever. For example, if a young, for example, Somali gang stabs someone, they will claim and they will say, oh, that was. And I was very sad to read the tweet of our current president-elect this morning when he said he was someone who was recruited by ISIS from Somalia who didn't even deserve to come to our country. I think we need to be very careful in times like this. We just need to diffuse the tension and not play into the narratives of ISIS.
Mm-hmm. Barbara in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Barbara.
Yes, it seems to me that if somebody wants to be triggered into a violent attack, then that person will look for and find whatever messages will justify the violence they want to do. If they strongly identify as Muslim, yes, they will look for and find and expose themselves to lots of messages telling them Muslims are persecuted. If someone strongly identifies as Christian, they will look for and find and expose themselves to lots of messages telling them Christians are persecuted. They'll listen to the war on Christmas stuff, that sort of thing. I think the problem isn't any particular faith or political belief. It's that we have so many people who want to do something violent, who feel that doing something violent will fix whatever is wrong in their lives.
Barbara, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. You're nodding your head.
I agree with our caller. It's not about faith. It's not about religion. It's a political agenda with a ideological problem. That's a deadly combination.
And you know, the mental issues here too. I mean, yeah. I don't know in this particular case, but mental issues is a very big issue, especially in immigrant communities where there is not that much access to mental health professionals. That has played a part in some of these attacks.
So do we know about any incidents of harassment of Muslims since Monday's attack? Has there been, you've talked about all of the great outreach that people have made.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, it has not been reported to our office in the last 2 days. However, since the election, as I said, we've had over a dozen reports of Muslims being harassed. But thankfully, at least it has not been reported to our office in the last 2 days. And we hope that continues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which means we are seeing a growing awareness among Americans in general that that's not the route.
Yes, thank God. Finally, people are able to separate an isolated incident, which doesn't represent the collective expression of a religion or an ethnic group, and events like this. So, yeah, people are much more better than before.
Well, Horsehead Noah, I want to thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Horsehead Noah is the director of the Abu Bakr As-Siddiq Islamic Center. And also Roman Iqbal, thanks again for joining us as always.
Thank you.
Roman Iqbal is a staff attorney for the Ohio chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.